WXYT Detroit AM 1270 presents Weinberg on the Law. Here's your host, Scott Weinberg.
Good morning, America. It's like a little cloudy this morning, but we are here to talk about all your rights, everything going on in the legal community here in the beautiful state of Michigan, outside of Detroit. The major thing going on, obviously, in this state is always the economy, but how it affects, really how it affects all the individuals here. We're going to get to a couple interviews today, but one of which is Rabbi Pinson that runs the Friendship House, trying to really help everybody who has any kind of substance abuse problems, any kind of mental health problems, but really trying to deal with family situations here in Detroit. So we'll hopefully be able to get him on the line and talk to him, and might even get the infamous Jeffrey Figer on the line, talk about what's going on in his life and in the community, but also his new movie that depicts him, and of course Dr. Jack Kevorkian. See if we can't get him on the line. We all know that Sam Riddle's out of jail after 3 days. That's unbelievable. Of course, Sam Riddle, he's still refusing to take any kind of plea deal in the Riddle case. And as the Free Press will tell you, now we'll be allowed to speak with his former girlfriend, even though there are restrictions. You know, one of the things on any kind of assault or domestic violence case, they, at least most of the time, they'll have, you can't have any contact. No contact, no third-party contacts. Here, he was supposedly texting his old girlfriend or his old significant other, Mary Waters, and then they violate him, put him in jail, of course, take pictures of him in his jailhouse blues, and then after 3 days, boom, he's back out. And I don't know whether or not they have any kind of further restrictions on it, but he can now have contact with her. He can basically have what it basically is called free reign, which is really a no-contact order lifted, allowing him to discuss many different matters. And many things that happen in these cases, especially perhaps on this, is the complainant doesn't want to go forward with it. The prosecutor does. And if that's the case here, it just creates huge havoc with the prosecutor's office and the victim's rights unit. So we'll follow that closely with what's going on with Sam Riddle. But you know, the thing that really just caught my eye in what happened this week was that case out of Battle Creek from years ago, that Tom Kress has been in prison for, what is that now, over 25 years. Tom Kress was convicted of raping and battering a Battle Creek teenager, leaving her body in a trash-filled ravine back in 1985. And of course, the case has been going on for many, many years, where now they might overturn it, saying that because of the evidence, it was improperly gained and then not preserved. Since then, his case has been argued through the state and federal courts, really in just a bewildering history of lost and destroyed evidence. And even though there was a confession from an Arkansas killer, there's been, this is who's been involved in this. The U.S. Senator Levin, they're getting Jennifer Granholm's office involved, and prosecutors, so they are trying to get him out. They're trying to commute his sentence. But of course, the prosecutors, as typical prosecutor, says that, no, we don't want him to go free. Yes, there might have been some issues back when he was convicted, but we want him to stay in. So now there's a bid for his release before the board, that advises the governor on whether or not his situation should be overturned. And I really want to get to the crux of that, because we have, anytime you have anybody convicted at trial, obviously they have a right to appeal. And different rules apply in different years, but basically you get convicted at trial, you get a right to appeal, and it can go through different levels of government. It can go through the Court of Appeals and then eventually the Supreme Court. If there's constitutional issues, it can go to the Supreme Court. But when you have, in this case, you have potentially tainted evidence, or not even a lot of evidence, but the evidence that came in that was tainted or not preserved for that appeal, it creates huge havoc. And that's one of the things that that our court system is dealing with right now is, what do you do with a guy who's sitting in prison for a quarter of a century and he might be innocent? In this case, they had the detectives that were involved that came back, Battle Creek detectives, now retired, and they were involved in the case. They themselves think that there's no way that he did it. They are quoted saying there's no way that Tom Kress killed Patty Rozanski, who is, of course, the victim in the case. And he's one of the retired detectives. So what happened was they got the University of Michigan Law School Innocence Project involved. Go Blue. Thank you very much. And on March 15th, the attorneys for the Innocence Project tried to convince the state parole commutations board and send a message, basically, to Jennifer Granholm, let this guy go. The board will have to decide whether to recommend to the governor, who will make the final decision. So the clinic argues, and this is one of the main things you really ever want to think about when you're thinking, okay, someone's convicted. Should we ever let him go based on any kind of evidence that you find in the future? And they argue that he was convicted on dubious testimony, meaning basically the testimony was either coerced or just flat out lies that were presented to the jury. The physical evidence that might have cleared him in this case was lost. Conveniently, of course, but it was lost. So what do you do now? You've got a guy sitting for a quarter century. The testimony might have been wrong or just flat out lies. The evidence that could help this guy over all these many years is destroyed. And there's other evidence that not only was just lost, but destroyed by the prosecutor. So what do you do with it? How do you, as a governor now, look at it and say, well, we got the victim's family on one side that and prosecutors that feel he should stay in. And then you get another side where you've got a senator, you've got the respected clinic that's presenting all the evidence, and you've got admitted evidence that was lost. You've got testimony that the only person involved in this has already died in prison. So what do you do with it? Well, the Calhoun County prosecutor and one of her further assistants and the family, of course, are arguing to keep this guy in. The turmoil is reflected also in the attorney general's office, who says that because of the complexity of the case, that they feel that they'll even concede because of this evidence being lost, because of what happened with the attorney back then, that they'll concede that this defendant, Kress, might be innocent. So I don't know whether or not any of you are just incensed about this, but I am. Not on both sides. How can we lock up someone for so long and not know whether or not it's really true that we should have him in there? This is even before DNA evidence was even used. This is in the early 80s. They weren't even dealing with that. It was way too expensive, way too complicated to be dealing with DNA evidence. This is basically a conviction on testimony and now lost evidence. So if you want to get involved in this discussion, I encourage you call 248-851-1270, 248-851-1270. And now that Kress is 53 years old, obviously he's a completely different man, but, you know, like anything else, listen, if the guy did it, of course, and there was a proper conviction, he should spend the rest of his life in prison. I'm not arguing that he shouldn't. But if he didn't do it, or if they can't come up with the evidence to show that that evidence back then was even legitimate and preserved, then I don't know, maybe we should let him go. But that's up to, obviously, the governor, and hopefully that she'll make the right decision. So we'll talk about that and some other issues. Hopefully get Mr. Feiger on the phone and listen to the rabbi here on Weinberg on the Law, 1270 WXYT.
Have you or a loved one been arrested or charged with a crime? Do you want to stay out of jail and try to keep your record clean? Then you need the attorneys from Weinberg Law at 1-800-7100-LAW. And if you call right now, they can qualify you for a payment plan designed just for you. That's right, an affordable top criminal law firm. Call 1-800-7100-LAW. Stay out of jail, keep your record clean, and qualify for payment plans. Call now, 1-800-710-0529. That's 1-800-7100-LAW. You're listening to Weinberg on the Law on AM 1270 WXYT. Here's your host, Scott Weinberg.
Good morning. Here we are welcoming to the show Rabbi Pinson, basically the recovery rabbi here in town. Rabbi Pinson's co-director of the Friendship House, and he specializes in helping people through addiction and recovery. He's worked with more than 400 recovering addicts and families. Welcome to the show, Rabbi.
Good morning. How are you?
Good. Rabbi, one of the things that I really was interested in talking about is Friendship House. Tell us a little about Friendship House and what kind of good work you guys do over there.
Well, the Friendship House is a section of the Friendship Circle that deals specifically with recovering addicts and their family members. I came here about 8 years ago to direct this organization, and we have developed a lot of good relationships with recovering addicts and their family, and we support people who want to quit their drinking or their drugs or their other behavioral addictions like gambling and sex addiction and eating disorders. We help them through the first steps of, you know, developing a need and a want to go to through a recovery process. We help them find resources locally or whatever is needed for their specific problems. And then when they come back from treatment, we help them with the networking with other people in recovery and spiritual support and guidance, finding the right therapist. If they have any issues with their addiction, their relapse or stuff like that, we're there for them.
Well, you know, being a criminal lawyer here for over 20 years, what I have thousands of cases of clients that their addictions, their substance abuse problems have so negatively affect their relationship with their families. And people don't realize, they always focus, including prosecutors, and I used to be a prosecutor too, but they focus on the specifics of the defendant and what's going on with him, but it translates so much into how it affects the family through substance abuse.
That's correct. And we, you know, within the recovery communities is a strong fellowship of Al-Anon, which is for family members of recovering addict. You know, I work a lot with family members. Usually the first call that I get is usually from a family member. It won't be from the addict himself. It'll be the family, you know, "Hi, Rabbi. You know, this is so-and-so. I would like to know if you can help my son or my daughter or my wife or my mother, my brother, you know, because they're addicts, and we want to know if you can save them, you know, cure them, fix them, you know." And obviously, then that's not something that I can do to fix other people. But I do point out to the family members what you said, that the behavior of the addict doesn't affect only the addict, but it has a very negative impact on the family members and all the loved ones. And because of that negative impact, they have an obligation to take care of themselves also in the process, not only to see how to save another person, but, you know, I'm being exposed to such stress because of the addict in my family, and if I will continue to be under that level of stress without taking care of myself, I can't be there for the addict. So it's important for all members of the family to seek help, not for the family member that's using, but for all the family members that are, you know, emotionally attached to him.
Rabbi, how do they, if they're out of work or they don't have insurance, how does it get paid?
Well, there's many options here in Oakland County to get help if people don't have insurance and they're really interested in getting help. The first place people call is PACE, which is the Office of Substance Abuse at Oakland County. And if the addict himself or herself calls, they would get an appointment, and if they don't have any insurance, they would be referred to a local treatment center depending on the needs, if it's only detox, if it's a 7-day program, or in cases of dual diagnosis, people can be referred to long-term programs 6 months and a year covered by the Oakland County.
Rabbi, if because of the economy, and there's so many people out of work now, and we had actually Kim Worthy, the Wayne County prosecutors, on the show last week. Do you find that the whether it's crime rate, but that the needs for your services have gone up tremendously over the last couple of years, focused specifically because people are either so destitute or they're so upset or depressed because of their working or living situation?
Yeah, we're definitely in a recession-proof business, if you want to call this a business. But we do see that the stresses of life are taking a toll on people, and the tools that people naturally have to deal with such stresses are not readily available. You know, you don't go to school and, you know, learn math, science, and how to deal with stress. You know, that doesn't come in the curriculum. So a lot of people are just ignorant about their options that they have to help themselves in such situations, both practical solutions where they can get help to find a job and with their legal problems and the health problems, and also emotional solutions to deal with those stresses in a healthy way rather than go to a mood-altering substance or unhealthy behavior. So we do see a lot of people these days, and not all of them are addicts, actually. A lot of them are just using drugs and alcohol as a, you know, self-medicating temporary solution, and, you know, if with the right support and the right guidance, they can go back to their good lives without having the need to go back to the substances.
You know, as long as I have a record, and quite frankly, I don't think I've ever asked a rabbi this. You know, there's a new law. It's medical marijuana.
Yeah.
What's your take, or the your take as a as that type of caregiver regarding people's use of medical marijuana? So it's specifically given to them on a medical card, and but it's still a drug. I mean, it's still something that is, I guess, a false sense of comfort basically taking care of them. How do you deal with that in terms of your recovery?
Well, I deal with medical opiates all the time. People are prescribed Vicodin and Percocet very easily here in the United States. Anybody who comes in and says that my back is in pain or I have a headache, they're given heavy opiates, which is basically another form of heroin and a pill.
Well, those are abused so much, not only in prescription, but in use.
These are used and abused, both by people who are looking to abuse them and others who are just get hooked because of what they were prescribed. A lot of people go doctor shopping to get the opiates that they want, not that they need. So going back to your question about medical marijuana, I mean, if only people who needed it would get it in the doses that they need them, that would be one issue. What I worry about is that other people who want it utilize this cover to get access to drugs that really are not good for them.
Right. We're talking to Rabbi Pinson from the Friendship House. Rabbi, one of the other things that I am always curious about, too, because, you know, as a criminal lawyer, we deal with people clearly to keep them out of jail or to damage control or try to protect their civil rights. But once they go to jail and they come out, what's it like for the families or the defendants once they come out of jail in terms of dealing with recovery?
I get a lot of people who come to us after having spending some time in jail. And, you know, when I deal with family members and parents especially, and they come to me and they say, you know, my son is using, my daughter's using. I said, have you explained to them the legal implication of, you know, of owning, carrying, and using controlled substances that are illegal? And, you know, besides the health issue, there's a legal issue, and kids end up arrested with DUIs or possession and other things like that. And the first, the parental instinct is to bail them out. Parental instinct is, I don't want my son or daughter to spend the night in jail. I don't, you know, I'm going to pay for the top lawyer so they don't get consequences. I see this a lot, especially in our community, and I think that there's a little, you know, disadvantage here for the kids, that they don't necessarily see a consequence between their action and the sentence or being in jail, because the consequence is taken away from them by well-wishing parents who don't want to see their kids suffer. I counsel parents and I tell them to have conversation with their children before the legal problem come and say, if you're going to want to smoke or do all these things, you know, I can't, you know, make you stop, but if there will be a legal issue, you're going to be in charge of it. It'll be your consequence, not my consequence. I talk to parents who are basically financially ruined because of all the money they invested in lawyers to save their child from being in jail. Let me tell you a story. I once had a parent come to me, and, you know, their kid was arrested and didn't know what to do, and I begged them. I said, please, let him stay in jail over the weekend. It was a Memorial Day weekend, and they told me, fine, we'll wait till after the weekend, then we'll come together with him to see you. And when they came to I spoke to them on Sunday morning. I said, "So how's it going?" They said, "It's great, but we didn't listen to your advice, and we bailed them out. But because of the weekend, the legal weekend, there was some trouble in processing the papers, and he's still in jail." I went to visit him in jail, and then he got out. And a few years later, he's clean now for years, but he always tells me, "You know what changed everything for me? The weekend that I spent in jail. And if my parents would have bailed me out on a Friday morning, I would have thought that I can still do this for another few years."
Well, there's no question that many parents, and through the years we've seen it as criminal lawyers, many parents are enablers and enable the, once someone gets charged with a crime, come up with excuses that basically continue on that.
That's correct. That, and I think that the legal community can do a good job counseling the parents. I definitely think that they should have a lawyer, and a good lawyer would help them find the right consequence for the child that would, sometimes it's not children, and I want to tell you another story. I have this mother that calls me and says, "Rabbi, can you help my child?" I said, "How old is your child?" She says, 45. I said, "I think that's where the problem starts. You know, if you think that a 45-year-old person is just a child, then they're not going to take responsibility for their action." I do think that people need legal representation, but I think that the legal community, the lawyers and the judge, come together with the right consequence that would teach a lesson out of the fact that this person was involved in something illegal and possibly harmful for their health and, you know, and their behavior.
Well, here at Weinberg Law, we try to help the families out, that's for sure, and that's quite frankly why we try to keep the cost down and offer payment plans for families, just like the ones that go to Friendship House that really need the help. Well, thank you, Rabbi. We appreciate it. Rabbi Pinson from Friendship House. We'll have you on again, and if you ever need any help, just call the show, and we'll help out some of your patients.
Thank you so much, Scott.
Take care.
Thank you. Bye.
That was Rabbi Pinson. Hey, you know, one of the things about Friendship House, it's really such a good organization, but, you know, you really, when you're in need of any kind of substance abuse counseling, the main thing, especially if you have any criminal case going on along with that, is to seek help. Because while you want to hire the attorney, obviously, to do the criminal case, there are professionals that really can help you and your family through any of the types of substance abuse and other types of psychological issues going on with the case. So I recommend going and talking to Rabbi Pinson at the Friendship House. Well, we have a treat this morning. We are going to be, we have Jeffrey Feiger on the line. He's one of the most successful and, quite frankly, controversial attorneys in America. His father was, of course, a well-known labor attorney here in Detroit. Jeff's one of the most respected criminal lawyers and malpractice attorneys, which has celebrated cases as, of course, Jack Kevorkian, which we'll be talking about. He had the Scott Amador case in 1999, that wrongful death case against Jenny Jones. And then he represented the young man who was killed and the family who was killed in the Columbine High School massacre. He won the Democratic nomination for governor in Michigan in 1998. And quite frankly, Jeff, you got one of the nicest buildings I like in Southfield. Welcome to the show.
Thanks very much.
I just want you to know, my dad had a building years ago down the street from your building, and, oh, man, your building is just so nice. It really takes up a whole city block. I like
it. Well,
it's
not one building. It's taken years to do. I've actually purchased about 6 or 7 or 8 buildings on 10 Mile and then donated them to Blight Busters, and they actually are still existing somewhere. They were moved, and they're providing housing in other parts of the Detroit area.
Well, I like those buildings, that's for sure. You know, one of the things we want to talk about is, of course, You Don't Know Jack, which is going to be coming out on HBO starring Al Pacino. Tell me about your experience with working in this movie. Did they counsel a lot with you to set up this movie?
I guess as much as anybody else, probably more than any of the principal characters. I was hired as a script consultant, so they consulted with me in terms of the script itself. The reason they were able to get so many really great and talented actors and directors, Barry Levinson won the Academy for Rain Man and was the director, Al Pacino, Susan Sarandon, Brenda Vaccaro, John Goodman, Danny Huston plays me, is because the script is just a magnificent work of art, and it stands alone, and that's how they were able to get such great people because they don't pay competitively. In other words, HBO doesn't pay what feature films pay, but then again, they don't spare any expenses in terms of the production. It's a beautiful, beautiful, nobody should get the idea it's a made-for-TV movie. It's not. It's a theatrical production. It's being played on HBO. In Europe, it will be played in theaters, and then it'll be released on DVD. And I saw it in completion on Thursday at the premiere in New York, and I have to say, it's a very, very compelling movie.
How did you like Danny Houston's portrayal of you?
Well, I once said this to some Ben Bradley. Was asked how he liked Jason Robards' portrayal of him in All the President's Men, and he said, "I was great." I said I couldn't get away with that, but Danny Houston is a very good Jeff Figer.
Well, you know, you're also involved in obviously the lawsuit against the writer in Hurt Locker, a lawsuit on behalf of Master Sergeant Jeffrey Server filed a federal lawsuit. What's going on with that?
Well, that's pending in the federal court in New Jersey, and that was that's just an out and out, as far as I'm concerned. In the law, we call it appropriation, but it's really stealing someone's identity for profit. And that's exactly what the writer and the producers did in the Hurt Locker. They embedded themselves with Sergeant Sarver's unit. The screenwriter wrote an article for Playboy. Anybody who cares to read it would understand, if they also saw the movie, that they're identical. And the only thing that's different in the movie is that he changes the name of Sergeant Sarver to Will James. But other than that, it's the same person.
Did they acknowledge it at all? Did they say that, yes, he was involved?
Well, no, they've been caught. They did. I mean, you can't not... nobody with any common sense or any intellectual honesty at all could read the Playboy article, which is where the article appeared first in 2005, and then not realize that the Hurt Locker is exactly the same as the article. So they say that for the press, and you know, but this is all stuff. They can never go to trial with that case. I'm not posturing. I'm just saying I wouldn't have taken that case if you know, it's not somebody coming out of the woodwork saying, "Well, gee, that sounds like me. I was in Iraq at the same time. I defused bombs." Hmm. That isn't the case here. This is the screenwriter. He was with Sarver. He wrote about Sarver. He wrote an article which is identical to the screenplay of the Hurt Locker, and he's the writer of the Hurt Locker.
You know, Jeff, but you take on cases like that. I mean, let's face it, whether they are controversial or not, I mean, you really have a history of when you see something and you see a wrong. I mean, I followed your career for years. You take it on, whether it's in Columbine or whether it is something, you know, people can say about Jack Kevorkian now, but when you took that on back then, you know, nobody really... nobody had the guts to take on the system like that. I mean, that's really one of the things.
Well, they were afraid. Most lawyers were afraid. All the lawyers that Jack had gone to, and I wasn't the first lawyer he had gone to, was afraid of what it would do to their practice, what the authorities would do to them. I just saw it as a civil rights issue.
You know, Jack is quoted as saying, "I always felt my career and everything was a failure. And it may be," Kevorkian said, "but I feel successful now because of the freedom I have to do what I want to do, and you helped them do that." Did you guys have discussions like that?
Basically, that's sort of what the movie's about. And ultimately, Jack always did engineer his own failures. He could have been a very successful person in a lot of different endeavors. He's very, very bright. And he kind of undermined even his own success in the issue he was proselytizing by in the end representing himself. But that's what, I don't want to give away the movie, but that's the movie.
Well, I remember the case, but he also and he still talks about it, and I wanted to ask you about it. When he says, "When a law is deemed immoral, you must disobey it," and you know, when you have something like a jury nullification.
Well, you know, wait a second. He didn't say that. That's what we said at Nuremberg.
He's just quoting 45 years
ago. The American forces and the American judges, when we hung the Nazis in Nuremberg, said that because that was their defense. They were following the laws. If anybody wants to see that quote, watch Judgment in Nuremberg with Maximilian Schell and Burt Lancaster and, you know.
You know, we need, and this movie I'm sure will depict it, we need lawyers that are always, I guess, capable but also interested in taking on the system. And I know that you started at Michigan State University, the Trial Practice Institute there. And, you know, we have so many lawyers coming out of law school these days. What advice would you give these young lawyers coming out in terms of what kind of cases to take on?
Well, first of all, they don't get a choice. Unfortunately, most young lawyers don't get a choice. They have to take the cases that come to them or where they work. But I advise all young lawyers that if they're going to law school to make a whole lot of money, or if that's their desire in life, then they're in the wrong profession. And they won't be happy. And that's true in any profession. And also, it wouldn't hurt young lawyers to go work for the public defender's office. It wouldn't hurt young lawyers to take criminal appointments. But when I hear these young lawyers competing to go work at these corporate law firms who put them in a box and work on a pyramid scheme so that they make these young lawyers work 2,500 hours and
no trial experience.
Support, you know, the corporations, that's disappointing to me. And frankly, most of those young lawyers end up dropping out of the practice. They find it very disappointing.
Plus, they don't get any trial experience, too, for all that hard work they're going to put in there.
No, they don't get anything. They're just they're cogs in a wheel.
Well,
spokes,
Jeff,
in a wheel.
I agree with a lot of what you say. I don't always agree with everything you say, but I agree that young lawyers coming out definitely should be careful where they start off with, but it doesn't matter what you make when you're coming out. It's the experience you get, and you always should love what you want, what you're doing.
If you love what you do, you'll be successful, and that's true if you're a plumber, if you're a gardener, if you're a garbage collector, if you're a lawyer. If you don't love what you do, you shouldn't be doing it. And unfortunately, most of the people who go to law school, at least from my perspective, just went to law school for the wrong reasons.
Well, it's obviously you love what you do. Everybody, I would encourage you to see You Don't Know Jack. I wish I had an early screening of that, but I will be watching that coming out next week on HBO. Jeff, thanks for coming back. Hope to have you back.
Thanks very much.
Bye-bye. That was Jeff Feiger. You know, Jeff, he is, if nothing else, you obviously can tell, not just through his work in law, whether you like him or not, whether you think he is abrasive or not, he loves what he does. And, you know, whether you have kids, just like I have kids, or whether you don't have any kids, but you are working in this economy here in Michigan, I don't care if you're a lawyer or not, you got to like what you do. I don't care if you start off with an internship, you start off not getting paid, you come out of law school, you want to represent people. It is a great idea to do what you love, no matter what, you're getting paid, at least in the beginning, especially when you're young. And I would recommend any of the lawyers coming out of school, and I would absolutely agree with what Jeffrey Feiger was saying on it, is you go get a job in the prosecutor's office for low pay, or the public defender for little pay, or you take court appointments, because that's how you learn not only the system, that's how you are able to figure out what area of law you want, how to represent people's rights, how to protect your own professional interest in what you want to do, because that's how you get your own type of ethics and morals, is from working with the people, not sitting into a cubicle somewhere like he was talking about in corporate America and not ever seeing the light of day or even a client. So I think it's good advice. We're going to take a short break. If you have anything you want to talk about, especially with commenting on with Jeffrey Feiger, call us at 248-851-1270. This is Weinberg on the Law.
Have you or a loved one been arrested or charged with a crime? Do you want to stay out of jail and try to keep your record clean? Then you need the attorneys from Weinberg Law at 1-800-7100-LAW. And if you call right now, they can qualify you for a payment plan designed just for you. That's right, an affordable top criminal law firm. Call 1-800-7100-LAW. Stay out of jail, keep your record clean, and qualify for payment plans. Call now, 1-800-710-0529. That's 1-800-7100-LAW. You're listening to Weinberg on the Law on AM 1270 WXYT. Here's your host, Scott Weinberg.
Welcome back. Well, we had the opportunity to talk with infamous attorney Jeffrey Figer and hear some of his ideas, obviously, and what's going on with his new movie, which, quite frankly, I can't wait to see. And we're going to switch gears a little right now. Talk a little about what's going on in this state with family law and father's paternity rights.
We want to welcome to the show Ellen Painter. She's an expert in family law with Painter & Associates and really one of the top family lawyers in town. Welcome to the show, Ellen.
Hi, Scott. Thanks for having me.
Ellen, one of the things that are going on, and everybody is aware, obviously, of how bad the economy is. And, you know, I talk, and I'm in court all the time, and I always talk with family lawyers who just can't believe how many of either one or both of the divorced couple that are coming into court are not represented by an attorney because they say they can't afford an attorney. And they go in front of a judge and are completely taken advantage of by the system. They don't know what's going on. Or the judge would send them to the library. I just saw it yesterday. They'll send them to the library to say, well, go research it up at the law library, and then come back when you know what you're talking about. What's going on out there?
Well, that's true, Scott. That is happening more and more now because of the economy we're dealing with here in Michigan. And you've hit it on the nose. The court clerks are not allowed to give legal advice. So if you go unrepresented to the courthouse, they're not going to tell you what you need to do, what forms you need to have, and they will send you to the library.
I was going to say, don't you see, though, that let's say that you have one side where you're representing just one side and the other one doesn't have an attorney. I mean, just plain as day. Would you rather the other side have an attorney? Would you rather be dealing with it, as in this case, like a default divorce where the other side isn't represented?
You know, it really depends. There are a lot of couples out there that are able to reach an agreement without having both parties represented. As an attorney, I can't represent two parties in one divorce case, but there are several cases where I do have just one party that I'm representing, and they advise me what their agreement is with the other party, and I draft the documents. And when we go to enter that judgment of divorce, I make it clear on the record to the court that I've only represented the one party, that I've not provided any legal advice to the other party. And you're right, they are at a legal disadvantage if they have not consulted with an attorney.
You know, I can see some benefit, I have to admit. I mean, it definitely would keep the total cost down in terms of attorney's fees, but you really have to have a couple that's working well together to do that, don't you? I mean, they really can't be too contentious because you need some type of counsel, something to, I guess, go between those two couples.
I agree. And I've seen several times those parties unrepresented at court in contentious cases where it frustrates the judge because the unrepresented party doesn't know what they're doing and they're wasting the court's time by attempting to litigate on their own.
Do you find that with the bad economy, and we were just talking to one of our divorce attorneys or bankruptcy attorneys in town, that because people's major asset is their house, that because so many people are underwater now, that's affecting whether or not either affecting their divorce or whether or not they're even filing for divorce because their major asset might not be worth anything?
It does, and I provide free phone consultations. And in my phone consultation, that is generally the biggest issue other than custody and parenting time in the roadblocks to making an amicable agreement between two parties. They can't decide what to do with the house. If your house is underwater, you don't have many options. And usually one party cannot assume the home if it's underwater. So you're really looking at foreclosure or short sale as your only options in that situation if you pursue a divorce.
We're talking to Ellen Painter, one of our foremost family law attorneys in town. You know, Ellen, there's a crazy issue that came up recently, and I wanted to talk to you about it. It's basically, and it was also in the article in the Detroit News, the biological dad fights for parental rights. And it's my understanding where, and you correct me if I'm wrong, if you are married and the wife has a baby, but it turns out that baby is a child of a different person than the father, the rights still go to the married father, not the biological father. Is that right?
That's correct. If you have a child that's born during a marriage, the husband is presumed by state law in Michigan to be the legal father.
That sounds insane.
Well, you know, there were reasons for that type of a statute when it was entered years ago. And really, it was the state of Michigan not wanting to bastardize a child. And that's really, if you went back and looked at the initial background information on the reasoning for this law, that was it. So we do have a change in the way that our society looks at something like that today. So would I see the statute changing sometime in Michigan? Yes. Do I see it changing this year or next year? Not necessarily. There's usually always a bill floating around in the state legislature about changing this area of law.
Do you think that with family law the way it is right now, or at least in the state, that the difference in a change in governor is going to change anything regarding how our courts or the legislature is either conservative or more liberal in its stance in terms of helping out either fathers or mothers in getting the children?
You know, I really don't see a change in a governor making that much of a difference. It's really our state legislature that changes the statutes and has the responsibility for drafting those statutes. So it's really who you elect as your local state representative that's going to affect that more than anything.
Is there a bias at all you find in the state regarding custody for the child for or against the father?
Well, currently there is legislation that they're trying to pass that has more of a everybody's entitled to joint custody feeling to it. Whereas right now, the way the statutes do read, there is no real definition as to joint custody. It does mention it in the statutes, but it's not defined as number of overnights. And so then you're looking at what people think of as sole physical custody, as your general custody standard in Michigan. And it really is more the local judges and their leanings as to how they interpret the state laws in awarding custody. The statutes are pretty gender neutral on how you are awarded custody in Michigan. It's the judges' interpretations of those statutes. And there are judges locally here that do lean in favor of one specific gender rather than the other.
Do you find that it's the gender of the judge that makes a difference? You have a male judge, they're more likely to go one way, or a female judge, more likely to go for the woman or the man?
Interesting. Locally here, it's generally a few older male judges that prefer to award custody to the female.
Hmm. Well, my dad would probably give custody away, too. We're talking to Ellen Painter, one of the foremost family lawyers in town. Ellen, thank you very much for joining us. We'll have you back on the show to talk more about family law and the current state of divorce in the state of Michigan. Thanks a lot.
Thanks, Scott. Give me a call anytime if you have any more questions.
Take care. But the phone lines are nuts about this whole thing with Kevorkian. I don't know why people find it so polarizing when Jeffrey Feiger is on the line. I mean, he is a lawyer who really takes on, in many cases, the hard cases. But when you have an subject, when you have any kind of movie that comes out, you know, everybody actually always has opinions about whether they're true or not. We got Big Ben here. And Ben, you know, one of the things that I know you're curious about is whether or not these cases are, when they depict them on the movie, whether it's HBO or in movies, can they be real?
Yeah, I mean, just something that if, you know, you're a movie watcher, you stay till the end of the credits, they always have that disclaimer at the bottom, you know, anything, names, likenesses, locations, it's just purely, you know, coincidence, happy stance. I mean, isn't that like kind of like a protective blanket?
You know, just because they put it on there doesn't mean, one, that it's legal. So if they have something at the end of a movie, or even at the end of, like, say, these YouTube now on the internet, there's all new rules about how you can legitimately show any real true story, but you claim it as your own. So let's say that you have a depiction of something real happening, a court case, someone who, let's say, an accident and it really was going on. The question is, do you have to have a disclaimer saying that these people consented to it, or that it is a situation where this is a real case? Or if it's actors in there that are pretending to be reenacting something, do you have to say this is a reenactment? And when something, you have it just like with this, what's it called? You Don't Know Jack. That is obviously a true story based on a movie based on a true story. And the question is, how exact do they have to make it? And when you get to the other thing that that Feiger was talking about, his lawsuit with the Hurt Locker, is it now, because they're not involved with it, can you sue because someone else stole your idea, even though it might be an accurate depiction of what goes on?
Right. And also, you know, you have movies that are always say, you know, based on a true story, and those have embellishments because, you know, creative control of a director wants to say, well, you know, maybe I want to have, you know, some of this stuff over here, you know, change it a little bit. But they don't get affected by something like this. So, I mean, how is that any different?
But in Hurt Locker, you know, what Feiger's saying is, listen, this was totally stolen. This was no credit given to, what's his name, Master Sergeant Jeffrey Sarver, that this was all his life, that this was his true story. And they gave no credit to him. You know, they might have made a deal with him saying, listen, we're going to buy the rights to it. They could still have at the end of that, and any depictions are simply coincidence, because you don't know if Master Sergeant Sarver wrote it correctly or if he told it correctly. So what he might have said isn't correct. But when you have lawsuits like that, listen, you know what? Anybody can sue anybody for any reason.
Right.
Period.
Right.
You talk about the ethics of things. You don't need a legitimate case to sue. However, lawyers ethically are not allowed to take on cases that they don't believe are just, that they believe there's some basis for it. But you get an individual that feels they've been wronged, whether it's true that they have or not, they try to get a lawyer to try and sue. And what Feiger's saying is that Feiger really believes in this guy. And if it wasn't something that he didn't believe happened, he wouldn't sue. He would feel it's unethical to be able to sue for something that you don't believe happened. However, anybody can sue anybody for anything.
Right.
So just because they say, oh, no, this is my story, I'm going to be suing, I don't think Feiger would have taken this case. But whether you have another lawyer that will say, hey, that was the song I wrote, you know, 30 years ago, and they took it, and it was really with the, you know, the Shirelles, and now some hip-hopper made it into mine, you know, you get some lawyer that's going to say, yeah, great, we'll make a little money on that.
Yeah, I mean, it's definitely an interesting case and an interesting outcome, because like he mentioned in the interview, just listening to it, it could, I mean, you never know, it could open like a floodgate because, like, of just incidents of maybe, you know, Sergeant John Doe says, well, maybe that was me too.
Right.
Like maybe that's my story.
Right. What about other soldiers
exactly.
that are
I
in
mean, it's
the
just
movie?
Interesting how it's going to just, you know, do that.
But when you have actually lawsuits that are based on someone else's ideas, so let's say that someone wants to copy your web page and don't give you credit for it. Listen, we all grew up and we all heard about plagiarism. People getting kicked out. Well, all this really is another form of plagiarism. It's stealing someone else's idea. It's stealing someone else's words. It's stealing someone else's song. And there are specific rules interpreting what is your, what's called intellectual property
right.
and what isn't. And the basis of any lawsuit with that is vast. You can have so many different ideas of what your idea was, but you got to document that it was your idea. You got to be, whether it's your song or whether it's your story or whether it's your website, you got to be able to show that that was your intellectual property, that that was your story, and that you were not paid or were not given permission for it.
How would you go about doing it? How would you go about protecting yourself in something like that? Could you give yourself, I guess, what some people refer to as the poor man's copyright, like kind of mail?
Just put the C on it?
Well, you know, mail yourself the original copy so it's always postmarked and date that, you know, this was like around the time it was created.
Yeah, it really is the poor man's, my friend.
Right, yeah. I mean,
it's the price of a stamp.
Well, you know, 41 cents is a lot of money. But...
Well, no, I mean, there are specific rules with copywriting and with trademarking that, you know, you really, if you want to protect something, you really have to do it properly with not only the state, but with the federal government. And the problem is most people never do that. One, because it costs a little money to do it, to hire an attorney, although quite frankly, it's not that expensive to copyright material as it is to trademark material. But, you know, you can always keep your records. And if anybody's listening and wants to be able to do that, you should always just keep your record of your original ideas with it. You should keep it with the federal government. There's a form you file with copyright protection. And I would recommend you have a lawyer that can at least review it. Even if you're not going to spend the money to have a lawyer do the search for it at the federal copyright at the trademark office, at least you can have a lawyer's advice on it. Maybe a future show we'll have a copyright lawyer talk about some of the different issues on it. One of the main things, especially whenever you're dealing with people trying to steal your ideas or that you feel that you want to sue, my recommendation is obviously don't go it on your own. I don't care if it's a criminal case. I don't care if it's a civil case. You know, there are so many lawyers that are reasonable, whether you want to call us at Weinberg Law or if you want us to refer you to a specific type of attorney that we may not handle. Just give us a call at 1-800-7100-LAW. That's 1-800-7100-529. And I'm happy to have our staff, or if you want to talk to me personally, deal with that. But I can tell you, don't go to court. Don't file your case without having proper representation. You wouldn't fix your toilet without a plumber. You wouldn't build your house without a builder. You wouldn't do it without a proper plan. And if you go to court and if you have any issue regarding what you're doing, you don't know exactly what you're doing, you are not prepared. So please call a lawyer, call our office, call someone. Get some advice so that you know exactly what your rights are. Because the one thing that I hate to see, and Ellen Painter talked about it too in family law, is people going in front of a judge, getting taken advantage of, and not knowing their rights. So wake up, America. You need to know your rights. You need to know that anybody other than your lawyer is not going to protect them as best as you need it. So call us at 1-800-7100-LAW. This is Weinberg on the Law.
Weinberg on the Law on WXYT Detroit, AM 1270. The preceding was a paid presentation of the Legal Line Network. Opinions expressed are those of the advertiser and do not necessarily reflect the views of WXYT and CBS Radio.
1270 AM, WXYT and WXYT HD Detroit, a CBS radio station.